Good morning, gang. Good morning. Happy Saturday to everybody. The sun's shining and we're here and it feels fantastic. I'm excited to get going today. My name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. And with that said, I'm going to launch into this thing. This is my favorite thing to talk about, is steps 4 through 9. The way up and the way out of alcoholism. And it all started with that third step where we left off last night. And, you know, the mess of a life that I had created, and understanding that for the first time, and it was clear to me, and it was presented to me that this is the way up and the way out, kid. And when you get on your knees and you say that, what I thought at that time was a goofy third step prayer, and I was told, you know what, when you're on your knees, you're halfway to your feet. And I felt that. What a powerful statement. We put pen to paper. That's what our book says we do next. We launched out on this course of rigorous action. And I explained, you know, he said, we start with our resentments. That's what the book says. You know, they're deadly to the alcoholic. That's why we start with them according to this set of instructions. And we put them down on paper. We went back through our lives. That was the other key instruction. Where do I start? How do I get going with all this? You know, it says we went back through our lives. Does it say we started in the beginning and went forward? No, it says we went back through our lives. The most urgent, the newest resentment is the one that's killing me today. And if I'm going to drink, it's going to be today. So I'm going to start and work backwards according to this instruction. I didn't know what resentments were. I said, I don't have any. And he said, what do you mean you don't have any? He goes, it's what you do. He goes, you're used to taking inventory. We all take inventory. You know, we do it every day. It's what we do outside the meeting when everybody's standing around smoking cigarettes. You know, some people were probably doing it out here last night. You know, who's this clown Rich? You know, this guy's in his 6 year sobriety. Why is he here? What is he talking about? You know? Go home and write it down. You know, my sponsors, he said, you stand outside in front of the meeting and, you know, that's what you're always talking about. Oh, God, Bob shared for like 40 minutes again. I know what that guy's going to say every time he opens his mouth. He goes, that's perfect. Write it down. And that's all it was. And a lot of times, you know, when at these step meetings, I'm going to try not to be theoretical as I go through this, but I'm also not going to be extremely specific. I'm going to do it somewhat of a general way. I think that Doug later is going to, you know, really buckle this down to the specifics of the steps. But he said, right now I'm going to say a sentence. You're going to take a piece of paper at the top. You're going to write, I hate. All this is a list of who you hate and why you hate them. And I had no idea that if you look at this book, that's the first and the second column of the fourth step. I'm resentful at who and why am I resentful at them? I didn't resonate with that language, but who do you hate and why do you hate them? Boy, I was off and rolling. He said, I'm going to say, I hate, and you're going to tell me the first name that comes in your mind. I hate. Who is it, Rich? And I said, Melissa. And he said, good, write it down. Who's Melissa? I said, Melissa's the girl that's been living with me. She's been living with me rent-free. She does all my cocaine, drinks my beer, pays no rent, doesn't contribute to groceries. Good, good, write that down. You know, and I'm writing it down. You know, eats all my food, does my cocaine, drinks all my beer, doesn't work, works at a restaurant, doesn't come home at night. I'm pretty sure she's sleeping with somebody. Good, write that down. Sure she's sleeping with somebody. You know, and then what does this affect? You know, what's it affected by? And I'm doing this with coaching, you know. It says we went back through our lives. For some people, everybody does this different. We meant me and somebody else. I'm not very good at inventorying my own life. It's sort of like grading my own paper. You know, I give myself an A or a B every time. I don't know what you all do. I'm not so good at it. I need some outside input. A sponsor is a neat job. It's a neat thing because what that is somebody that's emotionally detached from my life. They can look at my life as if they're somewhere looking in. And they have a whole new perspective. And what's the fact? What do you think that affects, Rich? You know, self-esteem, perhaps? She's out sleeping with all, yeah, self-esteem. How about sex relations? Oh, yeah. Write that. Sex relations, you know. Personal ambitions, pocketbook, boom, boom, writing it down. I did this with everybody in my life. Going back as far, and he said, it doesn't have to make sense to anybody but you. Put it down. We did this, and then we turned back to the list again from a different angle. What did I have to do with any of this stuff? And what we were looking for, this isn't some confession list of, you know, bad, that's what I was afraid it was. That's what I was afraid to do. All we're looking for is patterns in my life. He's helping me see what I do over and over and over again that I can't even see that I'm doing. I have two good eyes, but still can't see. He had a fresh pair looking in. And as we went through this thing, he said, well, how did you meet Melissa? Well, same way I meet every girl. I met her at a bar. Well, what did you tell her? Well, the same thing I tell every girl. I'm a big shot drug dealer, babe. Come with me. Life's going to be sweet. You'll never work again. And it's going to be great. Yeah. And then they're with me for about a month, and they see the reality of it. You know, I'm a deadbeat drunk. Big promises, and I don't deliver. You know, a lot of fun for a week. And then it turns out that this girl, Melissa, was married and going through a divorce. You know, and I said the same thing to her that I'd say to anybody like that. Come with me, don't worry about him. You know, get away from that guy. What a loser. It's going to be fun with me. Oh, you have kids? Well, he's got them. He's got them. You know what I didn't realize? I made that divorce 10 times harder than it would have been. And that woman didn't get to see those kids because that guy, he had a little bit of common sense, and he didn't want those kids to visit the mother who was hanging out with an alcoholic, deadbeat drug dealer. I didn't realize I was doing that. I didn't know I was keeping a mother from her kids. I didn't know I was costing her thousands of extra dollars in the divorce because now it turned into a contentious thing instead of an amicable divorce. I had no idea that I was causing all this pain because all I think about is me. And every relationship revealed the same thing. I go into it thinking of what can I get out of it instead of what can I put into it. You know, I suck from the stream of life instead of thinking about, as our book says, what can I pack into the stream of life? That was a revolutionary new way of looking at life, which is one of our definitions of an awakened spirit and a new attitude and outlook on life, is each day I'm going to approach, as I did this morning and I do each and every day, God, help me see what I can pack into the stream of life instead of take out. It's a new way of looking at things. I'm sharing this stuff with him about each and everything. And, you know, we did the same thing with the fears and the sex conduct. And what I learned was a manner of living, a life skill, or some spiritual tools, some people call them. And that's what the inventory process is. It was a, you know, the first time we do this, it's a look at our grosser handicaps, is the language our book uses. I've done so many inventories since the first. Some people say, you know, you do the first 9 steps once, and that's cool. I mean, I don't care how anybody else does stuff. I'm not here to tell anybody anything about how to live your life or do stuff. I'm telling you what I've done. I've done a lot of inventories. More is constantly being revealed on a lot of different levels. You know, and as I shared that, he turned some of the deepest, darkest stuff in my life into things that I could freely talk about in front of anybody. The scariest thing, I would not share this at a big conference. You know, I like these type of gatherings because they're rather intimate. And the biggest thing, the thing I was never going to tell anybody ever anywhere. You know, I was about 11 years old. You know, we're in sex ed class. I learn about sex. We come home. We got the little family Yorkshire Terrier, and I had to give it a whirl. You know, I just learned this stuff, and I told this man about this. And he's, you know, and I said, I've been carrying this incredible guilt and remorse and shame, and, you know, I don't fit in with the rest. What if anybody knew this about me? Can you imagine? I mean, what if anybody knew this? Like, I'm some type of demented freak. And he goes, demented freak? You've been carrying all this guilt for all this time. He said, so what you're telling me is you learned about sex in class at 11 and 12-year-old. You're guilty of being a curious 11-year-old boy. That's all you were. You were a curious 11-year-old boy. I'd have never thought that. I'd have never come up with that in a million years. It's good to have a sponsor. And as time passed, about a month goes by after I share this, you know, fifth step, and I start to get emails from him. And Roger would send these emails with a picture of a Dalmatian, and it would say, here's a looker, you know? And I'm starting to laugh about this thing that was, you know, and then a golden retriever would pop up 2 weeks later, you know, and he'd go, here's one to look out for. And he's making a joke out of this thing that was the heaviest thing I carried around. And about 6 months later, we're in a fourth step meeting. And he did something that changed my life forever. In front of all of these people, he looked at me and he said, tell them the story, Pooch. And from that day forward, we get these AA nicknames. You know, I'm Richie the Pooch. And that's on some CDs places, Richie the Pooch. You know, and what a great thing that's just become one of the funniest things in my life. It's done one of the scariest and shameful things in my life. And what great power. And you know what? There's what's going to happen after this meeting, because it happens every time, is somebody's going to walk up to me and go, you know, I have. And I'm going to go, yeah, no big deal. You know? That's the thing about this. You know, we've all done stuff. The secret is mine, not the world's. This stuff all has names and stuff for a reason. People have done it. I decided that it was bad and shameful. But I didn't learn this until this process. What a freeing process. And it talks about how we're going to start to feel after the fifth step. I think the fifth step promises, you know, are some of the most wonderful stuff in our book. Every now and then when you get asked to read the promises at the meeting, I'll start reading the fifth step ones just to rattle it up a little bit in the meeting. No, you're supposed to be on the ninth. I said, well, he sounds pretty good. And I'm a big fan of, you know, comfort the afflicted, but afflict the comfortable in AA. So we move on quickly to the sixth and the seventh step. And I did, you know, my first go-around with this the way it is in the book. You know, I sat quietly for an hour. And I will tell you, it says, you know, we were ready. We're ready. It's written in the past tense. I don't know that I will ever be as acutely aware and as ready to have this stuff removed in my life that was very clearly objectionable to me for the first time. And that's the important part, I think, about that step that it talks about in the 12 and 12. There's a lot of things about my life that might still be objectionable to somebody in this room. But a lot of my life was objectionable to a lot of people, judges, mothers, girlfriends, all kinds of people. But for the first time, there was things in my life that were objectionable to me. And I was willing to have that removed by this wonderful power that had just relieved me of stuff that I'd been carrying for decades. And I'd been staying sober, you know, for nearly, I bet, 6 months at this point. Something miraculous indeed was happening in my life. And whatever power y'all were talking about, you can have it. And we transformed these lists into this eight-step list. I've heard all kinds of stuff, and again, whatever anybody's into, you know, rock on. But burning and stuff and sending stuff. I live by the beach, so everybody, you know, sends their fourth step into the ocean. And I mean, just, we're going to light a bonfire and you're going to burn your past and it's going to be gone and you're going to be liberated. I don't know how any of that works, but if it does, cool. I needed all of that information for my eighth and ninth step. So I would recommend not burning it if you plan to do an eighth and a ninth step. But that's just how it worked for me. And there's two spots, you know, where Bill keeps reminding us that we have agreed to go to any length for victory over alcohol. The fourth and the fifth step and the eighth and the ninth step are where I've seen more people cheat themselves in Alcoholics Anonymous than anywhere else. And anybody that's ever sponsored anybody, that's the two spots where we lose them, right? When it's time to write inventory, all of a sudden they're gone. When it's time to do the amends, you know, they're gone or going to do them half-ass. And at this point, I'm working with Roger, and we're to this ninth step thing. And at that point in my life, getting close to a year sober, year and a half, starting these things. I have what I think is the best job in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm vacuuming swimming pools out. And I don't know if anybody knows anything about the vacuuming pool business, but you got to do it from like 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. because people like to swim, it turns out, during the daytime. And I didn't think anybody woke up until noon or 1, but they like to use these pools, so they have to be clean. So I'm up with the sun, and there's something cool about that, and I'm not sure what it is. Some of you probably did it today, but I love it. You know, I've never heard anybody die saying, I saw too many sunrises or sunsets. I've just never heard that. And so I'm doing these pools, you know, and I'm done by 10 a.m. and I get to a 10 a.m. meeting sometimes or noon and I go surfing and I'm developing these hobbies back in my life that I traded in for alcoholism a long while back, but they're things that I love doing in my life and I'm doing them again. And I'm out swimming with the dolphin and sea kayaking and my life is exploding and I'm making a little bit of money doing this pool thing and I'm making like $500 a week, and I think I'm like a millionaire. I don't know what that is with AA, but when you stop drinking, you get a big pay raise, even though you're making less money. Anybody experience that? I mean, I always have money left at the end of the week, and I'm making next to nothing, and it seems like I'm making more than I ever had. And I'm happy, and I'm having fun in this deal. And I start with, you know, my mother. You know, she's the person that I hurt the most and couldn't look at me, and she loved me the most. And my father had, you know, divorced and moved off, you know, kind of left the family, and mom couldn't even look at me without her, you know, head just dropping to her shoes. And she loved me to death. And it's worse for me. It was worse knowing that she was disappointed and sad and let down and fed up and sick and tired. And those things, you know, I prefer mad, you know, yell at me, hit me, do something, but don't just look at your feet in absolute disgust. You know, he said, you're going to make an appointment with your mother once a week if she'll do it. And you're going to take her to lunch or dinner, and it's going to be a standing date each week. And you're going to talk to her and be a son. Sons show up and they see their mothers. And it was Friday nights for me. And mom and I would hang out and do a dinner or cook together or something. And Friday night was, that's the thing with this ninth step. I always thought that there was supposed to be the right time or the right place or wait until the right thing happened. And I can tell you, with each of these, I never felt like the time was right. I never wanted to do it. I never had enough money to do it. I never had the perfect situation to begin. And that's what I was scared of, was that it didn't feel right. And again, I was reminded, as my new friend and I were talking about, nothing is really less important in AA than how I think or feel about something. It's what I do. And on Friday nights was a great group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ocean City, Maryland. It's called the Action Group, and they're called that for a reason. There's a lot of action going on in that group, man. They're in a live group of AA, and I love that these guys get there at 7. They're making coffee. It's buzzing around. They're at 3rd Street on the boardwalk, in case anybody's ever in Ocean City. And they get there, and, you know, it's a step meeting, and afterwards everybody goes out to dinner or up on the boardwalk, and they're riding rides, and, you know, and Schroeder likes to get shot up with this slingshot thing that we got to do together when he came down there. And I mean, it's just a blast. People do stuff. You know, we're not talking about deadbeat, middle of the road. I'm going to sit around, I'm sober today by the grace of God. Yeah. You know, I mean, what a statement. I'm sober today by the grace of God. And you can't get a little bit excited about that? Something's wrong, baby. You know, but so I like this Friday night group. I always wanted to be there. And at first, I didn't want to be at dinner with mom. I wanted to be at the action group, man, a part of the action. I've always wanted to be a part of the action. I wanted to be a part of the action drunk, and I like to be a part of the action sober, you know? And that's where I wanted to be, but I'm with mom because I said I would be. And for a while, I was with her because I had to be, and I said I was. And over a period of time, it changed that I was with mom because I wanted to be. And we became friends. And this little sister who hadn't talked to me in 6 years, I embarrassed her incredibly in front of friends and just did some god-awful, terrible stuff to this little girl. She just looked up to me and wanted to be with me, and I took advantage of that in every way possible until she was done. I had some Raven season tickets, and he said, why don't you give those 2 tickets? Why don't you mail them to your sister? You don't even like the Ravens. You know, you don't even like football. What you like is being in the parking lot, having a tailgate and being the big, big shot in the parking lot, you know, cooking a prime rib and slicing it and having the full bar and everybody walking by and thinking you're the big man on campus. And then you're so drunk, you usually miss the game anyways. So you don't even like the football. Give her the tickets. And I said, give her the tickets? She hates me. We haven't even talked. I'm not giving her anything. And he said, send her the tickets. And I sent her the tickets. She went to a game, I guess. I never heard anything. And then he said, send her the next week's tickets. I said, Sarah, she didn't even call me and say thanks from the first one. Are you kidding me? Send her the tickets. And I sent her the tickets. And something weird happened after that second game was my phone rang. And there was a little girl on the other end of that phone who was so excited. Did you see that pass he made into the end zone? That guy caught it. We ended up winning by 7 points. There was a minute and 30 seconds left. Did you see that? And we're talking about an NFL game, but I'm talking to my little sister for the first time in 6 years. And it turns out she then bought a little house in an area of Baltimore called Federal Hill, which is like an old city area that has been rehabbed, and all the yuppies are buying it up, and it's an overpriced shoebox that you fix up and sell for a lot of money. You know? And she's calling me, she's, you know, we need to paint this place, and we need to put a new hardwood floor in the kitchen. And I'm driving 3 hours on the weekends to go help her, because that's what I was told by you folks that brothers do. You know, you drive 3 hours each way to help your little sister because you haven't been there for a long time. And we became so tight, it's unbelievable. I thought she's one of my best friends in this world now. And a period of time went by and that friendship developed, and something absolutely phenomenal happened. Some young man called me up and said, "Rich, I know that your father's not a part of your life, and I know you're a big part of your sister's life, and I'd like to ask you for her hand in marriage." You imagine that? A drunk like me calling to ask my permission for a little girl that I had nothing to do with her life except for causing harm and damage and making her feel worse about herself, asking if I will, you know, consent to this marriage. So I said, "Well, Justin, do you drink?" And he said, "No, very little bit." "Well, you plan to make her happy?" And he said, "Absolutely." About another week went by, and the phone rang, and that same little girl called. And she said, "Hey, since Dad's not around, would you please walk me down the aisle and give me away?" And I got to do that, you know, as a sober man of integrity that you taught me to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Slowly, over a period of time, that relationship was rebuilt. A little bit by my actions, but mostly by your principles. I just participated in them. I didn't do much but go and do the things you suggested. And we have a paragraph here on page 78 that says, "In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens when we approach a situation and try to make our amend." I have found that to be so true, you wouldn't believe it. 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. And it touches almost every area of my life. And I've found most alcoholics I work with are right in here. And we have some real understatements in here. You know, second paragraph down, "Most alcoholics owe money." Are you kidding me? I mean, I don't know that it's one of the requirements for membership, but I worry about somebody that had gotten in a little trouble somewhere along the way. And I had this thing, I had a deal, it was an unwritten deal with the IRS, which is, you know, you don't ask anything from me, I don't ask anything from you. We just kind of mutually go about our business, but they weren't down with that after a period of time. And I owed him a lot of money. And he said, "You're going to call them and make a payment plan, because it says we don't shrug away. You know, we don't hide from our creditors. We try to straighten this stuff out." And I said, "If I call them, they're going to put me in jail. I got this nice little job, and you know, I have the relationship now with my mother and sister." And he said, "Rich, I'm telling you to call them and to set up an appointment." And all along with each of these things, as he would encourage me, with a very simple statement. He would say, "Rich, how free do you want to be? How free do you want to be?" And there's all different levels of freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous. He tells me, he said, there's all different types of sobriety. He said, "We can have anything from ground beef sobriety to filet mignon. What do you want?" And I knew by that point I'd been to enough meetings to know what he was talking about. I'd seen enough 20, 30, 40 year, you know, people sitting around AA, living sober, and their lives are, I'm sure, certainly better than we were drinking. But it wasn't anything interested I was participating in, you know. And I knew from the way I live drunk, man, I don't do anything halfway, you know. I want filet mignon sobriety. How free do you want to be? All the way. I don't want to look over my shoulder. You know, living in bondage of self, alcohol, we don't have a cent together, but we all got cell phones, you know. And what do they have on them? Caller ID, you know. That stuff was built for drunks. There was so many, I got to know who's calling me before I answer the phone for a whole lot of reasons, because there's all kinds of people looking for me for different things. You know, that's living in the bondage itself. If you call me today and there's people in this room, I will answer the phone. "Good morning, Rich Bruckner." That is a new freedom I've found through this. You know, I don't have to hide from anybody. That might not sound like a big deal, but that's a big deal in a guy like my life. You know, and what I brought to you, what I brought to the table in my area, they say, cast your lot in with ours and the result will be beyond your wildest dreams. What I casted into you guys was 36 arrests, one in 3 different states. By the time I finally ended up on mom's couch, I still had the warrant in California for a smaller cocaine case, not the federal one. I had the warrant in Colorado for the felony check fraud. And by this point, I'd gotten myself into a small jackpot in Maryland. I had a bunch of debt and I had a bunch of problems, and that's all I brought you. And this is the life that you've given me today, because I just cast it in. He says, Rich, how free do you want to be? I said, all the way, baby, let's do it. And he called the IRS. He said, you know what? They don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. They'd rather have something than nothing. And I always thought, you know, I had to have the whole kit and caboodle. You know, if I don't have $27,000 to make it right, I hide from you until I do. But I never will have $27,000 to hand you at once. You know, he said, you give them something. That's what it says here. And we arranged payments, and I started making the payments and making the payments and making the payments. And the guys in, you know, some of the guys in my group are going, come on, we're going skiing to Vail. We got the AA sober ski trip. You know, you deserve, God, you're doing your mother, your sister, you're doing great, you're paying the IRS. And I said, Roger, these guys, I mean, these are so many old timers, 36, 42 years, they want me to go skiing with them. He said, you owe the IRS money. You know, you'd be going skiing on their nickel. That's not your money, that's theirs. They don't want your money, they want theirs back. You know, I always thought people wanted my money. It was theirs that I was living on. You know, they don't want yours, they just want theirs back. So he said, what are you going to do, skip a payment so that you can go skiing? Come on, how free do you want to be? You know, and I didn't. I said, thanks, guys, maybe in the future. You know, and I kept paying. And I will tell you that it was a wonderful day when Roger and I drove to that Ocean City post office, and I put that last check in the mail to the IRS. And we just kind of had a little high five because that's how we react. You know, this little guy's 70 and full of energy, man, full of energy. And then about a year later, this really, really bizarre thing happened. I went to the mailbox and I opened this thing up and there was a check from the IRS. And I'm telling him about it. He said, that's called a tax return. Normal people have been getting those forever. And I couldn't even believe it. I've gotten a few of those. My best friend in the world was a guy I grew up with named Ethan. And Ethan had gotten married while I was out, you know, being a big shot drug dealer and trying to get through college and juggle all this stuff. And he asked me to be the best man in his wedding and fly back and to Maryland and be a part of this. And his father paid for my plane ticket and tuxedo and the whole shooting match. And I was too drunk to get on the plane and I was too drunk to call. Wasn't too drunk to call, I was too scared to call, let's tell the truth. Because when you're doing the wrong thing, you got to tell lies to cover it up, and the guilt and the shame set in. It's, you know, the cell phone thing. And then I'd see his number start to call the day after the wedding. And I knew what he was calling for. Where were you, you no good drunk? You're the worst friend anybody could have. And time went by over the years, and I heard that, you know, this woman was fantastic. And I'm hearing stories, they had their first kid, and they had their second kid, and these kids are doing this and that. And I can't talk to him, and I can't return a phone call. And Roger says, this is the next one. He said, you know, you got to call and ask to have a time to talk to him and make right. And I called and said, Ethan, I need to come talk to you about something. I'm sober in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a thing called the ninth step where I have to try to clear up the wreckage of my past so that I don't ever have to take another drink. I know you're probably really mad at me, but could I please just have a little bit of your time? He said, yeah, you can come down here next Saturday morning. You can be here at 7 a.m. if you can make it. And I deserve that, you know. So I left at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I drove the 3 hours. And I knew a couple things going in there in my mind. I knew that this wife hated me for not showing up at the wedding. I knew he'd told both of those kids about his scumbag friend Rich, you know, that hadn't been a part of his life for years and never even bothered to show up for any of their birthdays or the wedding or anything. And I knew they hated me. And I knew this was going to be tough in my mind. And I knocked on that door at about 7:05. And when that door opened up, his wife was in the back, his father, and this little girl darted at me like a beeline, and she grabbed onto my legs, and she looked up at my eyes, and she said, you're my Uncle Rich. Daddy told me one day I'd meet you. I didn't think that was going to happen that day. 9 out of 10 times, the unexpected happens. He hadn't told him anything like that. That was all in my mind. And I will tell you that I haven't missed one of their birthdays or Christmas, or a snow day since then. When there's snow days, I show up and take them sleigh riding and do that kind of stuff. And these little girls, they, you know how little kids think, they look up at me and they go, Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days, you know, like it's an accident, you know. But we know it's not an accident. It's a principle by which we live in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went in the other room with his father and I had a big pocket full of money because I told you about how I used to live, and in my mind at that point, still money fixed everything. And his name was Truett, and I said, Mr. True, doing this thing called the Ninth Step in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a home group, and I gave, by this point, I had the Ninth Step spiel down. You know, I'm getting good at it. And with each one of these, I'm building a little bit of courage about, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's always different than I think, so what the heck? You know, there's really not much sense in me wasting time trying to figure out how you're going to react and you're going to react, because it's never how I think. I've learned that much by now. I said, what do I owe you? I know you spent a lot of money on that wedding, and I didn't show up in a tuxedo and a plane ticket and all that, and I need to make this right so I don't have to take another drink. He said, is that right? You really have a home group, and you're really a part of this AA thing? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, good, you owe me $1,372. He said, but you're not going to pay me. I had that in my pocket. I could have paid him right then and there. He said, the way you're going to pay me is you're going to spend no more than $20 at a time. You're going to take a newcomer to a meeting. You're going to fill their car up with gas if they can't afford to get there. You're going to show up at your home group. You said they have food. You're going to take a lasagna. You're going to take donuts. You're going to, you know, buy coffee for the group. You're going to do something, but it's not going to ever be more than $20 at a time. And you're going to save each and every receipt. And when it equals $1,372, you're going to bring me the receipts, and on that day, this amends will be done. By the way, Rich, I'm 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been praying for you and Ethan since you've been that big. I didn't see that one coming. And then I went out, I'd cleared up this Maryland warrant situation, and he said, you know, you gotta go take care of this thing in California. You gotta turn yourself in. And that judge out there on this, I was given this thing called, it's a form of probation before judgment. It was a DUI, and I had a little bit of cocaine in my pocket. And it's called the PC-1000 diversion program for first-time offenders in California. And the judge said at that point, he said, Mr. Bruckner, you're in school. You know, I was a kid then. And I'm inclined not to ruin your life. I'm going to give you a chance. You have to do 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, this, that, and the other thing. And when you do that, it will be as if this never happened. It will just not even be on your record. There will be no trial or anything. I'm going to cut you a break. But if you don't complete those 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to give you every day of the 5 years that this carries. Are we clear? And I looked at that judge, as Chris and I both talked about last night, and with every bit of sincerity, you know, I said, absolutely, Your Honor. I will do whatever you tell me. You will never see me again. Thank you. And I truly felt like I was given a wonderful opportunity and a great break. But I told you about near misses. I required direct hits. And the other thing I didn't know at that point was that I did not have the needed power to stop drinking and complete 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I couldn't do that. I wanted to do that, but I couldn't do that. And I made a promise, you know, with a mouth that a body couldn't cash because the body had alcoholism and a mind that was going to take me right smack back to it. So I do what I already told you I did. When I don't do what I say and things turn into warrants, I run to the next state. So I go back to face this judge and to turn myself in and do this 5 years. And I told my sponsor, I said, you know, I really don't know what good I'm going to be doing anybody, because there's also paragraphs in the Ninth Step that I can use like weapons. Weapons for me are things of excuses and ways to shy away. And I could fuel that because, like I said, I'm just smart enough, you know, to be dangerous to myself and anybody that would listen. And there's paragraphs in here that, you know, a little disclaimer, like, you know, we don't think a man should make a showing where he turns himself in and goes to jail and is of no use to his family. And those are, and I said, well, you know, I'd be of no use to my family. What family? You're not married. You don't have any kids. You barely have a job. You vacuum swimming pools. This is a great time to go to jail. You know, I'm thinking like, what? Well, I think my life's pretty good, you know. What a great time to go to jail. And how free do you want to be? Well, I'm free. I don't need to go back to California. He goes, that's a pretty big state. If you do have kids and they want to go to Disneyland, what are you going to tell them? Oh, we'll just go to Disney World in Florida instead. You know, it's better. Maybe you'll make up another lie, Rich. Yeah. And he was right, you know. And so they confiscated a little bit. I still wasn't very good at saving money or discipline in that area. So they confiscated a little bit of couple of my paychecks, and off I went to California to turn myself in on this and face the music to this judge that told me he was giving me every day out of 5 years. And I'd written a letter to that judge, and my sponsor had written a letter telling him I was coming. It wasn't the heroics where this book talks about how we just show up unannounced and do something crazy and goofy. I wrote the judge saying, I'd like to do a self-surrender on this warrant. I'm coming. Can you please set this in for a date? And I had a date and a time to be there. So, I mean, this wasn't some off-the-hip, you know, deal, but believe me, it was plenty scary. And I stand here, and I would love to tell you that I did this with some type of dignity and grace, but that court date was at 8:30 in the morning, and from 7:30 to 8:30 in the hallways of that courtroom, I paced back and forth. I had sweat circles that almost touched my waist. I was in and out of the bathroom 3 different times doing different things, none of which were pretty, and it was just plain scary. But again, you all told me, we don't care how you feel, we care what you do. And I went in front of that judge, and what I didn't know had happened is a prosecutor that day that God put in that courtroom, I think, was downright obnoxious, you know, and told the judge, you know, Your Honor, you said that if Mr. Bruckner didn't do the 10 meetings of AA, he was going to do it every day of the 5 years, in your own words. And, you know, she's going off, and he just looked at me and said, Mr. Bruckner, what do you have to say? And I said, Your Honor, I really don't have much to say. She's exactly right. I didn't do what Your Honor told me. I could tell you a little bit about my life today. I do have a little over 2 years of continuous sobriety. I do go to a meeting about every day. I work with an awful lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing my best to stay sober. As a matter of fact, that's why I flew 3,000 miles here on my own nickel, is because I don't want to ever have to take another drink. And I don't mind going to jail. You told me that's what you were going to do, and that's what I sort of expect today. But that's a heck of a lot better than having to go home and pick up another drink, because I was afraid to do this. And he said, you know, I know that. Because what he knew that I didn't know is about 78 of you folks in my groups and the churches had written that judge's letters on my behalf. And he had them all up there. And he said, I have about 76 letters here, Madam Prosecutor, telling me about all the guys that he's working with and telling me about the lives he's touching and helping and telling me that he's a part of his community. And I ordered him to go to 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The way that I compute it, 2 years at a meeting a day, he's somewhere up over 700. Mr. Bruckner, go back to Maryland and please continue to do whatever it is you're doing back there. 9 out of 10 times, the unexpected happens. I didn't know that was going to happen that day. I couldn't believe it. Things like that don't happen. And when I stepped out of that courtroom, it was in the 9th step that I found my higher power. You know, and it says we will be amazed before we are halfway through. It's not talking about the steps, it's talking about the 9th step. When I'm halfway through my amends. So when people throw that around loosely in the rooms, you know, and this relationship that we get to develop as the result of these steps, it comes after, not before, and during, and somewhere in this process. I don't know. I've heard a lot of stories where it happens for everybody different. For me, I started to see God working in my life. You know, the spiritual life was not a theory at this point. This doesn't happen to people, and it just happened to me. My God got a little bit bigger that day. There was another guy in Ocean City that had more faith in me and his God than I had, and he was about 20 years sober, my buddy Rick, and he said, you know what, I want you to leave me a list. Rick does real well in business because he practices these principles in all of his affairs. You know, not in meetings or in his marriage or here or there. You know, he said, we have a set of principles that we live by in every area of our life. We're no longer compartmentalized. Because of that, he would stand here and tell you that you cannot help but be financially successful as well as mentally, physically, and every other way that we get to, you know, be rebuilt if you practice these principles in all of your affairs. And because I didn't believe him then, but that's what he said. But what he did say to me is, you know, I want you to list 5 people that you like the most that are your best friends in AA here. And when that judge puts you in for 5 years, I'm going to fly all of them out there and we're going to bring you a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if you're in jail, we're in jail with you. That's how proud that group, he's a part of that action group that I told you about. And how do you not go? How do you not have the courage to go do something when all that power and faith and belief that you all had, not me, encourages you to go get free? How do you say no to that gift? So I went, not because I wanted to, because you all believed. It was incredible. And I called my sponsor and I said, I'm coming home. I'm coming home. He didn't put me in jail. And I will tell you that that's a big deal to me. That plane ticket sits in the front cover of my big book. You know, I taped it in there because. So he said, well, you're not coming home until tomorrow. Since you didn't go to jail, why don't you take a little ride over to that school you got kicked out of? Those Jesuit people, you know, that are all about integrity and honesty and building men. And, you know, when you got arrested, that was in the newspaper. It was in the San Diego Union-Tribune. It was in the Los Angeles Times. Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. They don't like that, you know. Why don't you go talk to the president, you know, of the dean of that university? And I went over there. And this is the lady that had talked to me several times, you know, before she kicked me out and tried to help me. But I told you how I react to people that are trying to help me. If you're trying to help me, I always think you're trying to hurt me. But I saw it a little different now, and I'd had a heck of a lot of experiences to this point that I just frankly couldn't explain any other way than that saying there must be some wonderful power in AA. I've got a sister that, I mean, talking to my sister and mother after this deal and telling them I wasn't in prison, and I mean, shoot, how easy is it to go over to the school and talk to a president of a university that kicked you out after you just found out you're not going to jail for 5 years? I said, yeah, I'll ride over there. So I rode over there, and I get a hold of her. Her name's Dean Carrie Wilson, and I said, Dean, you know those years back when you would call me in and talk to me and you told me you thought I had a problem and you told me that my professors were telling you that I was up and down during class and running in and out and my nose was always running. And, you know, and I would tell you that I'm from the East Coast, I had allergies. And she said, you had allergies, you know, for 3 years, Rich. You know, and you asked if I needed help or wanted help, and I would just bold-faced lie to you. I said, it turns out you were right. You know, I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't even know it then. But I know it now, and I'm a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have this thing called the Ninth Step, where I have to come to you and try to clear up the wreckage of my past to the greatest of my ability so that I don't ever have to take another drink of alcohol. And I don't know how I could make up what I've done to the university. I brought you a great deal of shame and embarrassed this place, and I now know what the Jesuits are all about. And she said, really? Well, if you're serious about this, I'd like you to come with me. And I'd like you to fill out this application, and I'd like you to go to finish and graduate from our law school. And I'd like you to make us proud. That's what you could do, is actually graduate from our law school and make us proud. We like to graduate people. We don't like to kick people out. That's what makes us good, is having good numbers. I wouldn't have come up with that. You know, 9 out of 10 times, you know, the unexpected happens. And I knew some things. I knew that, and my knowing, you know, is what kills me and holds me back from getting free. I knew a couple things, that I couldn't afford to go to this place. You know, it was $33,000 a year. I'd used up every possible loan and credit and begged to borrow and stole from everybody in my family. I also knew that even if I graduated, that one of the things that Roger had me do was, my fourth step was sort of my version of my life. He said, we're also going to get an NCIC criminal background printed out, a rap sheet, and we're going to get your credit report, because those are the actual facts. You know, there's as Rich sees it, and then there's the facts, you know. And it's like, well, I see myself as a pretty good guy that had some small interactions with the law. And he said, well, you might think that, but this says you're an asshole. And, you know, and he was right. So, you know, there was I knew that even if I somehow found the money to, you know, finish this deal, that they were never going to let me take the bar exam because they have to approve your background, and I got 36 arrests. And even if I took the bar exam and somehow passed it, they weren't going to let me practice law because then you got to go in front of the ethics board. And he said, wow, you got it all figured out. All she told you to do was to go back and finish school. That's what you're going to do. What about this God you've been talking about now in your life? You think any of this stuff was supposed to happen? And I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that I was so far outside the realm of me, outside the realm of self. I couldn't have produced the results that you all were producing through this power in my life and guiding me through in a million years. That was so clear to me. And now all of a sudden, I'm always drawn back to doubt. And that was one of my earliest, stupidest beliefs, was that, you know, if you have any doubt, you don't have faith. Now I've found out doubt is an element of faith. You know, it's part of the deal. My God likes that, questioning, growing, learning, coming closer to, and realizing that I'm nothing perfect and never going to be. So she said, well, I have some good news here. I just inherited a piece of property that I have on the market for a little over $1 million, and I think I just got an offer. And for you to be able to finish, I'm willing to go ahead and pay for your law school. And as a matter of fact, I have an extra room in my house, and you can live at my house, and you can have an extra car that you could drive to and from classes. When I went out there, I joined a home group called the La Mesa Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one of the strongest groups of AA men that I've ever been a part of. If anybody's in San Diego, you will absolutely be missing. I mean, it would be like not going to SeaWorld or the San Diego Zoo, not going to the La Mesa Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is that cool. And I'm going to this meeting, and it's an old, I don't even know what year it was, I'm going to say 86-ish Ford Taurus, and it's got rust on the sides. But it's hers. It's the dean of the school that kicked me out, that let me back in. That thing felt like a Rolls Royce, baby. I'm driving that thing to school. And I couldn't even believe this was going on in my life. And it turned out I found another place to live. And it turned out that, you know, my aunt and uncle, who had long since given up on me, when I told them that I'm going, you know, back and getting to go to law school and that the dean's going to pay for it, you know, they rethought their relationship with me at that point. And they said, let me talk to this lady. And my uncle talked to her and got off the phone. And he said, oh, thank you very much, ma'am. We really appreciate that. But we're going to go ahead and take care of that. You know, so my uncle's pride, I think, stepped up, you know, because God uses these defects on any given day, however he wants. We don't know what's what. You know, he wasn't going to be outdone by the dean. If she had that much faith in me, doggone it, he was too. And I found out that a lot of people were like that. A lot of the ninth step is allowing people to participate in my life. People love being a part of a miracle. They don't get to do that every day. People like helping. When you ask for help, that's part of the amend, is allowing them to help and participate in my life and your life. You know, don't deprive somebody of a chance to be a part of your life. So I'm driving that goofy car, you know, and I graduate, and I come back to Maryland, and I get this, the best job that you can possibly get out of law school was in being the clerk for, we have two circuit court judges, which is the highest court of the land in Maryland, and I'm going to be a clerk to these two circuit court judges, and it's a two-year commitment for next to no money, but I mean, you can write your ticket to anywhere in the world when you're done this. And I've told my mother and my sponsor and everybody's, you know, my life has just turned around, and it's incredible. But the other part of the ninth step that I was told was, you can clean up the wreckage of your past, or it will clean you up. And I've experienced that. That's the alternative. I can clean it up, or it will clean me up. This was a state job. They send my stuff into Annapolis. It comes back to the judges, who I've already told the whole story of my life. They know I'm an alcoholic and all that. And, you know, and I've already been in front of the ethics committee. And I guess that bears, you know, repeating. It's just kind of a funny little story. I'm in front of this ethics committee, and they said, you know, you've got, God, you graduated with these wonderful grades, and you have these excellent references. You know, but what's with the 36 arrests? And I said, well, fellas, you guys all know that I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What you all may not know is that there's a substantial period of drinking required for membership. You know? And on this particular day, God put six individuals in front of me that laughed like you all just laughed. I said, all I could tell you is when I drink, that's what happens. And as long as I take another drink, you know, you won't have to worry about that. But if I do take so much as one drink, I promise you that you'll know immediately, and you won't want me practicing your profession. So now they send this letter off, the judges, you know, to Annapolis, and it comes back, and they call me in, and, you know, it's a week or two after I just got the job, and they said, we can't hire you. You know, I'm getting fired before I even start it. And they said, it came back from Annapolis that you have three felony warrants outstanding in Colorado. I'd forgotten about this. Honestly, they were not on the list. They weren't anywhere. They just didn't come yet. And I said, guys, this job does not start for 3 months, was my start date. Will you give me a chance to clear this up? So this guy was an old boss, and his name was Skip. And I told you about writing checks that I thought I deserved. And, you know, off we go to Colorado. And I go through the pitch again. Hey, Skip, you know, I'm a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've got this thing called the Ninth Step. And he said, you know what, this is what you owe me, and if you can get me a check by Christmas Day for that amount of money, I'm going to walk across the street and get rid of these warrants for you, because I don't want to jam you up with what's going on in your life. It sounds like you're living a different life. Did you say you're on the Ninth Step? Yeah. I have been to AA so many times and never made it past the third step. Really, Skip? Skip and I have a really neat relationship today. You know, I've gotten to be of service to that guy in a way that I never imagined, and those warrants went away. During that period of time when God moved that, and moved me there to take care of that, and that was the job that I picked because it was where I thought. I will also tell you, since I've been sober, I have never filled out a resume. I have never filled out a job application. My jobs come from you all, or they present themselves. It's a strange thing. But that one I sort of picked. And when I came back, I got a phone call. And it was from the state's attorney for the state of Maryland. And it turned out that they'd just received a really sizable federal grant and wanted to start a gang and narcotics prosecution unit. And he had heard from one of his lead detectives that I might know something about narcotics distribution. And he said, would you be interested in being assistant state's attorney for the state of Maryland? And I said, you kidding me? So I take that job because it's what presented itself, and that's what I do now. And I'll tell you, it was weird. It took a little bit, you know, those first couple of days, you know, when each morning when the judge would say, would the defendant please rise, I would, you know, catch myself a little bit. But I've gotten to the point where I don't stand up, you know, for that part. But I do stand up, and I get to say one of the most fantastic things that I ever get to say, which is, good morning, Your Honor. Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And I'm still in that job, and he tells me I have to stay there for a little while because I owe the state of Maryland. They spent a lot of time and a lot of money chasing me around and locking me up and that kind of stuff. And he said, you're in exactly the right place doing exactly what you're supposed to do. And I get to come in contact with a lot of you folks, our folks, every day. I would venture to say 80% of crime that I get to see has something to do with the disease of alcoholism or addiction, you know. And some judges and some prosecutors and some lawyers, they don't see it, you know. It's just a robbery. Well, it's not just a robbery. You know, why are they doing the robbery? We know why they're doing the robbery. Man needed a drink. And I get to, I just get to be around it and up close to it. And lend, you know, it talks about our deepest, darkest past. We get to go anywhere and do anything as long as we're standing on the firing line of life. I love the name of this weekend because I get to be right there on the firing line of life with you people, walking shoulder to shoulder, you know, on this common journey, a part of something in the world in a way that I've never been a part of. And my sordid past becomes my most valuable asset. And I have a defense attorneys on a routine basis, and I don't think they're lying. I think they're uneducated. There's only people that know and don't know. Nobody's right or wrong or good and bad anymore in my world. And they say, you know, this is Mr. Smith, Your Honor. We're going to ask you for the low end of the sentence because Mr. Smith has enrolled in and completed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 60 days, and he's really done a lot here to improve his life. You know, and I get to go, shh, time out. Your Honor, we need a few moments back here in chambers. We'll be back in a minute. You know, and I get to go talk to that other lawyer and say, hey, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't ever heard of anybody graduating from Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially not in 60 days. Did he get some kind of certificate or something that I need to see? And you know, and I just think they didn't know. And then the other thing is I get to talk to the defendant sometimes with their permission. I say, can I have a minute with him? So you're in this AA thing? Yeah. You have a home group? Yeah. What is it? How many steps are there in Alcoholics Anonymous? I lose a lot of them right there, you know? And then I know to go back in and let the judge do whatever he's going to do. But, you know, occasionally I get one that tells me, You know, I'm on step five, and I'm writing an inventory. I just shared it with my sponsor last week, and I feel great, and whatever's going to happen here today is going to happen here today. And they've got an attitude that I relate to. And I know that that's a man that's really trying. And I'll tell you, I'm about out of time this morning, and I want to leave it there with the ninth step, where this thing has brought me to where I'm really nothing special. I'm something called a citizen. And it turns out that that's what I was supposed to be all along. That's why it's nothing special. You know, I get up and I go to work, and I pretty much work 9 to 5, and I get to get up and go surfing this morning, and every morning just about. I live right at the beach and watch that sun come up. I don't want to miss too many of those. I've missed enough of them. And, you know, be a part of my mother's life and my sister's life. And my mother lives about 5 seconds away from me now. You know, when she needs, she's getting older, when she needs a light bulb changed, I can be there like that. And that might not mean much to many people, you know, but it means something to a guy like me. What'd you do today? Change the light bulb at my mother's house. You know, normal people don't go, wow, that's incredible. You're a hell of a son. You know, but come from where I came from, that feels pretty good. And a simple life has become a wonderful life. And again, I thank you guys for your patience and listening to me. It's just been such a pleasure to be here. And we'll talk to you a little bit more about what comes next, this 10, 11, and 12, for we have entered the world of the Spirit. Thank you.